Let's get started. Are there any announcements, Rob or Greg? Do you have any announcements for your sections? Okay, fine. What I'm going to do today, I'll do this two or three times during the semester. Is it still not on, Greg? It's the fun of audio equipment. This is on. Can you hear me now? Is it working? If it doesn't work, I'll just talk louder, I guess. Okay, if it suddenly starts blasting, tell me, but I'll just try to talk louder. Two or three times during the semester, I'm going to take readings that are particularly dense and somewhat difficult and give a kind of running commentary on the reading, almost in the sense, if you're Jewish and know anything about Talmud, it's a kind of midrashic commentary, a kind of attempt just to unpack a few of the concepts and make them a little more intelligible to you. I don't like to do this very often because it's not the most interesting way to lecture, but my experience is that it's useful because some of the concepts truly are tricky, and we try to pack a great deal of different things into the course. In some ways, this is an absolutely preposterous course, and I'm well aware of that because we talk about all kinds of different things. And in some ways, it's not preposterous, of course, because college education ought to leave you, in some respects, with more questions when you leave college than you had when you came. College or university education is not just to answer questions, but also to help you see a larger framework for asking questions and some of the ways in which it's fruitful to seek answers. So bear with me today. If this is a little bit tedious for some of you, I'm not an expert in the philosophy of science. I know a fair amount about it, but let me first explain why we're doing a little bit with the philosophy of science. There are two reasons. One, I think it's intrinsically interesting. Many of you, perhaps two-thirds of you in the class, are in one or another science. And it's my experience that quite a few of you will not do any formal philosophy of science as part of your Cornell education. And that's understandable. It's a very full curriculum. So the material is interesting inherently. It's also useful, I think, for those of you going into scientific careers. But also I'm doing it for a more specific reason in terms of the design of the course. Because very frequently, as we've already seen from our earlier discussions, there's a kind of dichotomy between scientific or factual claims on the one hand and moral or value claims on the other. And we've already looked at this dichotomy, and I've tried to challenge it to some extent and argue that although the mode of justification of scientific claims is typically or frequently, not always, but frequently different from the mode of justification in the humanities, the fact that it's possible to claim knowledge in both areas, if we think of knowledge as justifiable belief, means that the radical dichotomy between factual and value claims doesn't hold. And one of the ways of making this clearer is to point out that science is not nearly as straightforward as we sometimes think. Now, I believe that some postmodernist critics have gone too far. They've argued almost that science is purely a human construct, that it's purely subjective in some ways. I simply don't believe that. And if you go over into Baker or in other buildings at Cornell where they do physics and so on, they think those claims are really ridiculous because they believe science does have an objective as well as a subjective dimension. I'm trying to steer a middle position. My position, to summarize what I've said before, is really what in some ways might be called a fallibilist position. I believe that all human knowledge claims are fallible. We always may be mistaken, whether it's in science, in historical claims, in claims about economics, in moral claims, whatever. We are not gods, we are humans. We are intrinsically, inevitably embedded in particular historical moments of time, particular social milieus with a particular values and beliefs and prejudices and understandings of that time. I think a nice example was the goof I made the other day when I said the first settlers in this area came about 200 years ago. That is a Eurocentric perspective. These are very deeply ingrained in some ways because, of course, they weren't the first settlers. And I think that it's helpful for us to understand that all human knowledge claims are fallible and subject to revision. And one of the ways to see that the tension between moral claims and factual or scientific claims is not as great as we sometimes think is to see and try to understand a little more about the nature of science itself. Science is not totally value-free. It rests on certain basic assumptions about the nature of reality and indeed also about the value of science itself. I'm going to argue next week when I discuss the work of William Lice that one of the great discoveries of the modern world is that for the value of gaining power over nature through understanding nature more deeply, we have learned that one of the best ways to fulfill this value is to treat nature as value-free. That is to treat nature not in terms of beauty or goodness or considerations like this, but to treat nature in purely quantitative terms of mass, energy, causality. Treat nature as if it has no values in one sense, but this is for the overriding value of gaining intelligibility and ultimately power over nature. We'll look at this in some detail. This is, I think, one of the realizations that we often overlook when we deal with science. Sometimes in the synopses, when we get into the section a little later where we look at religion, I will get comments like this: religion is based on faith, science is based on reason. And you hear that frequently from people, even very top-notch scientists. But that is a huge oversimplification of the way life is. If you go to Jewish Seminary of America or Catholic University or, say, a Presbyterian school like Princeton Seminary, they reason just as skillfully and just as vigorously as they do in our Department of Physics or Chemistry or whatever. And what we quickly learn is that all human thought enterprises, whether in ethics, religion, wherever, the sciences, all of them rest on certain fundamental assumptions about the nature of reality, what we sometimes refer to as worldview commitments or worldview understandings. All of them entail both an element of faith and both an element of reason in various mixes. So it's not that religion is based on faith and not reason. Religious people think a lot about, quote, evidence for why this way of construing reality makes sense. And scientists don't just deal with facts. They deal with all kinds of theoretical constructions and also make quite a number of assumptions that are necessary for doing science at all. I've already, for instance, referred to the fact that you can't do fruitful reasoning at all without assuming the law of non-contradiction. You can't assume that if you believe that something can be both A and non-A in the same time, manner, and place, fruitful discussion terminates. You really have to assume that, but you can't prove the truth of the law of non-contradiction without assuming it. there is an inevitable circularity, really, in all human reasoning. The scientist has to assume that there's an external world. I touched on this briefly before. It's possible, theoretically, that nothing exists but my own mind. Solipsism is sometimes the name given to this, that you all are projections of my own mind. There's nothing fundamentally illogical about that. It just seems so silly. It just seems so contrary to all of our ordinary experiences. So we assume that there is a real world, and we assume certain things about that world in the realm of science. I think I gave the illustration that you really can't prove conclusively that the world is more than 10 minutes old, because it's quite possible that some very odd deity created the world 10 minutes ago, but created us all with certain memories, and the rocks with certain fossil histories, and the galaxies and light and all of this to look as if it's billions of years old. But it's really only 10 minutes old. You can't disprove that, but most rational people don't try to, because it seems so silly in terms of our ordinary experience, and it seems so silly theologically. What kind of a God would do this anyway? So there are many areas where we are forced back into the realm of common sense. And you can't think fruitfully in science or any other area unless you make certain initial assumptions. This is not fundamentally different from morality and from religion and philosophy and so on. You can't have, as I've claimed many times, a civilized, flourishing society. Human beings can't flourish as human beings if we can lie to each other whenever we want to, if we can harm each other whenever we feel like it, and so on. These are prerequisites for human flourishing. Now, you easily can come back to me and say, but what is human flourishing? Isn't that also subjective? Yes, of course. It has a subjective dimension. I'm going to shortly try to redefine subjectivity and objectivity. But again, this doesn't mean that claims we make about human flourishing are unreasonable or are false simply because we have to start with certain assumptions. Because if reliable knowledge depended on starting with no assumptions, we couldn't think about anything. It's just not possible to think about anything without starting with faith or belief or assumptions and not just dealing, so to speak, with the facts. This is very critical, I think, for understanding how ethics fits into the larger range of human intellectual activities and into culture, that we simply have no way of escaping our particularity, our embeddedness in time and history, and the fact that we're humans, not gods. But I'm trying to steer a middle course between the radical postmodernist critique that thus everything is relative and subjective, perhaps even in the sciences, and on the other hand, the kind of enlightenment certainty that grew out of philosophers like Descartes and others who believed that knowledge was a kind of certain understanding where we could have a kind of almost theoretical certainty about the way the world is. I don't think those are privileges we have as human beings, and thus I'm a fallibilist. I believe we can have reliable knowledge in science and in morality and other areas, but I understand knowledge, as I've said many times, as justifiable belief or warrantable assertions or claims for which you can give good reasons. Now, Barber is helpful in that he helps us see that science is one kind of knowing. And he very vigorously rejects the positivist view, particularly the view of the logical positivists, that only scientific knowledge is real knowledge. He refers to the theories of the logical positivists. Not all of this is in the reading I've assigned, and I'm filling in a little. And he refers particularly to their principle called the verification principle. And the verification principle of the logical positivists was that you ought not to accept as true or as meaningful anything for which you cannot give empirical verification. If you can't show empirical verification, if you can't point to specific sensory experiences, you really can't claim something as true or meaningful. It's not that other claims are necessarily false, they're just meaningless. They're like grunting or saying, whoo, or boo, I don't like that. This is sometimes called the boo-hurrah theory of epistemology or of ethics. You like some things and you say hurrah, and you dislike other things, you say boo. And that's the way it is. Only scientific knowledge really is fully meaningful because it's the only kind of knowledge based on empirical observation. Now, it wasn't very long before critics of logical positivism, this would have been back in the 30s and 40s and so on, came back and they said, wait a minute, what about the verification principle? It fails its own test. Because you can't provide empirical evidence for the truth of the verification principle. Either it's just a definition, and if it's a definition, why accept this definition of truth rather than some other, or it's some kind of tautology, or else you're just accepting it on faith, but why accept this principle rather than other views of knowledge? The verification principle fails its own test. You can't supply convincing empirical evidence for the verification principle itself. And this is why I think radical empiricism always fails. Barber is right, I think, when he says there are no uninterpreted facts. Or when he claims, and he's borrowing some of these expressions from other philosophers of science, when he claims that all data is theory-laden. Facts aren't just out there. Close your eyes just a moment. How many of you know whether I have rimless glasses or rim glasses, or how many of you know, let's make it a little different. How many of you know for sure the color of my belt that I'm wearing? One, two, about five. Okay, open your eyes. How come you didn't know that? You saw it, but you weren't interested. Why should you be interested in the color of my belt? If I came in the door with a black silk top hat and pink shorts and polka dot purple shirt and a fake mustache, let's say, you would have noticed it. You would have thought I'd flipped, you know, and maybe you could petition to drop the course. But it's not of particular interest to you that my belt is black rather than brown. In fact, I could have fooled you because it's reversible, and while your eyes were closed, I could have changed it, and then you all would have been in trouble. Science is not just collecting data out of which, in a kind of automatic, robotic fashion, emerges laws and theories and so on. You have to know what you're looking for. And to an amazing degree, as humans, we see what we're looking for, we hear what we're listening for. It's a little dark outside today, but let's imagine it was a lovely spring day with the sun shining and birds chirping and the grass waving and the clouds going by. There's virtually an infinity of data that confronts us wherever we are. Just within this small space here, there's virtually an infinity of data in terms of the CO2 you're expelling from your lungs, each little movement. Some of you wiggle more than others. Some of you look bored. I hope not too many. Your faces are extraordinarily alive and interesting. There's almost an infinity of data. Science isn't just collecting data, and then somehow out of this emerges your results. You have to know what you're looking for. You have a hypothesis, an idea about what may be going on. And science always involves this extremely active interaction between the data, so to speak, which are already value-laden, and the human mind. There is this constant interaction because the data as such, as Barber argues very powerfully, doesn't give you theories and laws and so on of science. These involve the interaction of the human mind with the data. And part of that interaction is already to decide what's the interesting or significant data in the first place. Now, Barber is right when he says there's no single scientific method. And in fact, I think he's also right when he says that it's usually more fruitful to think of science as a verb rather than a noun. It's a way or a range of ways of looking at the world about us. And it's a highly ascetic or limited way of looking at the world about us. It's not very useful at all. For instance, if you're trying to make a friend with someone, or if a man is courting a woman, I guess we don't use that, that's an old-fashioned term maybe today. It's not very useful in art history and so on. You don't want to spend most of your time analyzing the chemistry of the paints and studying how thick the paint is and so on. It has some relevance, but the criteria of being in love or of art or music appreciation, these are not areas where science is very useful. It's like the telephone book. It has a lot of variety, but not much of a plot. Science doesn't give you the kind of understanding that you often want, even though it is an extraordinarily fruitful and powerful kind of understanding for certain things. By severely restricting your gaze or your vision, you are able to gain a kind of understanding over the world about you that enables you to control that world in new ways. I think Barber is only partly right when he says that the major goal of science is intellectual understanding. I think some of the sociologists of science are more nearly right today when they argue that control over nature and predictability in a social sense is more nearly what drives science, at least in terms of funding science. Now, thank God there are still many scientists who just thoroughly love what they're doing, are totally curious about the world about them, and want to just understand. It's harder to do today in some ways than before because the funding agencies so often want results in 1 year or 2 years or three or four at the most. And it's harder to gamble today in a big way than it was before science was so heavily dependent on external funding. But I think Barber makes that point a little too strongly. Scientists, I think, in a social setting, are not just intellectually curious. They also, in many cases, at least in terms of how their activities are funded, are seeking control, the kind of knowledge that gives them control over the world about them. Now, science as Barber notes correctly, deals with public, not private, data. It's a personal activity, as the chemist and philosopher of science Michael Polanyi points out, P-O-L-A-N-Y-I, Michael Polanyi, particularly say his book, Personal Knowledge. He argues that all scientific knowledge, indeed all human knowledge, is personal knowledge. He doesn't mean by this that it's all subjective, but he argues that it's not purely private. What he means by that is that all knowledge claims that we make, whether in science or ethics or political theory, wherever, we are not simply expressing personal feelings. He rejects, Barber does, as I do, a totally relativist view of science and ethics and so on. We are exercising personal judgment. There's a huge element of personal judgment in doing science. That is, you have to decide when the data is really significant, when something is worth pursuing further, and so on. But it is not purely private judgment, because it has to be replicable by other scientists under the same conditions. It's public, albeit also in one sense personal. So the distinction, or should I say more accurately, the equivalence between personal and subjective doesn't hold very well here. All knowledge claims are, in one sense, personal and social, but they are not thereby purely subjective. Now, Barber redefines subjectivity and objectivity. He argues that objectivity is interpersonal testability with universal intent. That is, what do you really mean when you say this is an objective approach to something? It doesn't mean that you're God and you see things exactly the way they are. This is an absurd claim. We used to think that these chairs and tables were solid. That certainly seemed objective. But today, we're pretty sure that they're not. We're pretty sure that inside all of these, quote, solid things, it's almost like the solar system. All kinds of stuff is happening. So it isn't just looking and gaining experience. And it isn't just a personal claim in the sense of subjective. It's a claim which individual scientists and groups of scientists make, which then can be publicly confirmed, not by plumbers and theologians and children playing hopscotch, but by peers. It's intersubjective testability, Barber should add here, among significant peers, with universal intent. You're not just making a claim that holds true for yourself. It's not just about your feelings, how you happen to think about the matter. You're saying that anyone who looks at this in the same way and so on will get the same results. Replicability is an important area of science. So he redefines objectivity in this sense. And that sounds, at one level, as awfully subjective and relative and hopeless. But again, I think it's the human condition and predicament. The Enlightenment vision that we could somehow have sure knowledge that was totally beyond dispute simply does not seem to be where we are in science or any other area, because as Barber claims, and as is obvious to all of us, scientific theories change, they develop, and sometimes there are even major shifts, which Thomas Kuhn, in his book on scientific revolutions, published back about, 72, I think, really changes the whole way we think about a particular discipline Lavoisier when his contributions to chemistry, Einstein and Heisenberg and others, the modifications to Newtonian worldview, Darwin, evolution. In my lifetime, tectonic plates. Just think of the enormous revolution that came about with in geology with tectonic plate theory. It seemed absolutely absurd to people in the field when it was first proposed. But there was more and more and more evidence that supported it. And today, it's the conventional wisdom in the field of geology. Now, Barber is right also, I believe, when he argues that concepts, laws, and theories, that all of these are mental constructs. They don't describe something in the world as such. In the world as such, we believe they're just discrete phenomena. These are mental constructs. Now, it's a much bigger and tougher question, why things are the way they are. Typical Jews and Christians, for instance, believe God created the world in a coherent way so that it's lawful and so that it's possible to understand it. But in terms of science itself, whatever the origin of the world and the universe, the cosmos, when we develop laws and theories, this is a human activity where we are not just reporting on empirical data, we're engaging in a particular type of intellectual activity. Barber notes this. He says, theoretical terms are mental constructs which may be suggested by the data but are never given to us directly by nature. They have a status logically different from that of the data and hence offer a type of explanation that no mere summary of the data could achieve. The empiricist tradition has never adequately represented the role of concepts and theories in science. The empiricists who put all their emphasis on the data itself never adequately explained how does this data result in our getting scientific understanding and developing theories and so on. And Barber here refers to the leap of creative imagination. He says there's a logic for testing theories, but no logic for creating them. He notes the actual origin of the novel idea was sudden and unexpected and appears to have been the product of the subconscious mind, in which there is a remarkable fluidity of image combinations and freedom to break from established schemes. We all have this experience. I have learned over the years that the most fruitful time of the day in many ways for me is when I'm just emerging from sleep or sometimes when I'm taking a shower. But often, I think most fruitful when I'm just emerging from sleep, and it's almost as if there are trailings of the unconscious or subconscious that are just vaguely available to me. And sometimes I've been wrestling with a problem, an intellectual problem, a personal problem, whatever, and just as I'm waking up, I'll say, oh, that's the way it is, you know? I understand it now. It's an extraordinarily mysterious process, just like making big decisions. I think today we've been so influenced by management theory and so on that we think that when we make big decisions in life, where to go to school, what kind of career, who to marry, things like this, we see it in a very willful way. You know, you really got to sweat and strain and get it all logically in order. But I think in actuality, many of the really big decisions we make in life, in a sense, we don't make them at all in a voluntaristic way. It's simply that one day we wake up or one day we're walking down the street and we say, well, of course I'm going to ask so-and-so to marry me, or of course I'm coming to Cornell. Things have fallen in place because the mind was active at different levels And then the conscious mind has the role in part of simply ratifying something that happened at a deeper level. Now, mind you, that's a very, very tricky process because sometimes the subconscious mind fools us. And so in science, you can't just have a creative imagination. You also have to have some quite logical, rigorous algorithms and rules for testing your imagination, one of which is replicability, public authentication, and so on. And Barber gives us some of these rules. He points out, for instance, that these creative imagination, the results of creative imagination, has to be in agreement with observations. That is, it has to have some reasonable correspondence to the actual observable data. It has to be consistent and coherent. We do accept the law of non-contradiction. So you've got to ask yourself, is this new idea, this new theory, not only does it correspond with the data, but is it internally consistent and coherent? Does it square well with other things we know? And generally, in science, I think he's right, we want it also to be comprehensive. That is, we want it to have the ability to show underlying unity in what are apparently diverse phenomena. That it has to not just be a kind of ad hoc theory that concentrates just on this or that but has no relevance to the larger scene. If you're in physics and chemistry and so on, you want it to have more universality. And generally, we also want it to be a fruitful theory. That is, we want it to open up other avenues of research so that it suggests other ways we might gain knowledge about the world about us. And he notes correctly, again, I think, that we do not test theories one by one, but in bundles. A whole network of ideas is always tested at once. You may think you're concentrating on one thing, but you always approach that one thing within the very broad framework of your total understanding of science and the way the world is. So it's always within that larger framework, and that's why, in cases like paradigm shifts, why it's such a crisis in science, because suddenly that larger framework, at least in your own discipline, it's like an earthquake. It shifts, and you can't test in the way you did before. When relativity theory begins to take hold, it doesn't discredit Newton, but it shows that Newton's theories are more limited than we thought. And similarly with tectonic plates and other areas where there have been shifts of this sort. Barber says the whole process of testing is contextual and involves constellations of concepts and theories. And he argues again, I think correctly, that in a simple sense, you don't just simply prove theories to be true or false. He says the most that can be said is that it is in better agreement with the known data and is more coherent and comprehensive than alternative theories available at the moment. There may be other theories which will in the future meet those criteria as well or better. All formulations, this is in science now, all formulations are tentative and subject to revision. Certainty is never achieved in the sense of theoretical certainty. Now, you often hear, particularly among biologists, although I haven't heard it as much in recent years, there was a period of 20 or 30 years where they were very taken by the work of Karl Popper, who argued that you can't prove scientific theories to be true, but you can falsify them. And so you should always ask, is my formulation capable of falsification? I think that, too, doesn't quite work because it's not so easy to falsify theories. If you have seen any of the work of Richard Boyd in our own philosophy department, he's done some really brilliant work in this area. And he points out that just as in proving theories true, there's always auxiliary hypothesis, a context of other scientific principles that you have to accept. So in falsifying a theory, all you need is to drag in an auxiliary hypothesis or two, and you can't do it. A good example of this is my claim that the world is only 10 minutes old. You can't falsify that in any strictly logical scientific sense. All you need is a couple auxiliary hypotheses. But again, we don't try to falsify it because it seems so silly. We don't waste time. If you tell me that there are 150 pink elephants dancing on the arts quad down here and the Martians are herding them and giving them lollipops or something, I don't quickly rush down to see them, or I don't even argue with you. Because I think you flipped or just joking. It seems so silly. And this is true with falsification. There are all kinds of things that in a strictly logical sense you can't falsify. You just walk away from them. And this is the kind of thing you learn. I certainly learned it with my dad after a bad fall when he was about 93-4 years old. He began to get more senile, and occasionally his brain would get stuck on a particular track. And if you've worked at all been with aged grandparents or great-grandparents, you know that in many cases it's totally fruitless to reason with them when they get on that stuck record mentality. Usually the best approach is to try to distract them with something else. You just can't falsify what they're claiming. In the extreme case, there were a few times when my dad was hallucinating. He actually saw people in the room, you know, because his brain was a little mixed up. I can't prove in any totally logical, coherent sense that he was hallucinating, but I sure had a lot of reason to believe he was, and I didn't try to disprove his claims. So you can neither prove nor disprove. You can neither prove true nor falsify theories in a simple sense. This always takes place within a constellation of other beliefs and other theories. And he noticed, Barber notes correctly again, I think, that in practice, an experimental discrepancy, even though it always, quote, counts against a theory, does not have this absolute power to overthrow it, particularly if there are no alternative theories available. When a freshman chemistry student gets a very odd result on a standard experiment that's been repeated thousands of times, you don't suddenly say, Eureka, a Nobel Prize in the future for this kid. You usually correctly assume that he or she made a mistake. So even having discrepant data doesn't in any simple sense falsify a theory. It gets you to ask questions. It may lead to your rejection of the theory, but not in any simple sense. Most frequently, we dismiss some of these kinds of data as anomalies or unexplained deviations. And Barber correctly notes, he says the element of personal judgment enters in the evaluation of the data. The estimation of simplicity and generality and the relative importance ascribed to different data. Again, it's not a purely objective process. It's a strong element of human judgment. That doesn't mean, then, that it's subjective in the sense of untrue or purely relative. It simply means that this is who we are as human beings. Almost all of our knowledge claims are tested, confirmed, not confirmed in a social context. That's true in morality, it's true in science, it's true in all the different areas of our lives. And What happens from time to time is someone dares to think a different thought, which at first seems absurd, perhaps, but over time, this comes to be the conventional wisdom. Tectonic plates, slavery in the field of ethics. Most societies embraced slavery. Or in environmental studies, the earth is simply a resource to be exploited. Today, the gradual shift in thinking that nature has much inherent value and we need to rethink how we deal with nature. Let me, instead of going into the next section, let me pause here and see if there are any responses or comments or questions. Yes?
I think that religion is able to have the same sort of framework that it changes the time the way science does.
I think it does. In some ways, morality has probably changed less than science, but in a way that's a good thing. In other words, all human societies have rejected doing indiscriminate harm to other members of that society, and it's very good that that hasn't changed, because it's impossible for us to envision a good society without that. So I think, as writers like C.S. Lewis have argued, in morality, it's not clear that fundamental values change so much, just like it's not clear in science that fundamental assumptions about how you do science change that much. What changes in morality or ethics is the application of these principles. Philosophers like John Rawls refers to as reflective equilibrium. You may hold a range of different beliefs and then gradually come to understand that, say, and this happened, say, among Jews and Christians in relation to slavery, they gradually said, hey, what about these passages in the Bible here and here and here, and Christ died for all people, not just for white people, and so on. And they gradually realized there was a cognitive tension or a disequilibrium among the various things they believed true. And so through the process of moral reflection, they tried to bring these different values and beliefs into what some philosophers call reflective equilibrium. They tried to have more coherence and more consistency. That's not intrinsically different from what happens in science. The major difference between morality and, say, chemistry and physics is you can't run social experiments in the same way you run experiments in chemistry. But notice also, science has quite a wide range there, because in cosmology or archaeology or geology, you can't push all the continents back together again or go back to the Big Bang and rerun it. There, in those areas of science, you have more of a historical approach. So fields like cosmology and geology, archaeology, and to some degree anthropology and so on, these are sciences but different from chemistry and physics. And indeed, as I think I noted in an earlier class, in languages like German and quite a few other languages, Wissenschaft in German, science, doesn't mean what we mean by science. Wissenschaft is any discipline study of some particular area. So you can speak of a historical Wissenschaft or theological Wissenschaft or anthropological and so on. So yes, there are similarities here, but also some differences. One other comment, or did that help at all, or was that confusing? Yeah. Any other comment, or yes.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean when you say the theory that the world is chemical cannot be disproved? Like, yeah. Scientifically, that they don't understand that at all.
Okay. All that I'm saying is that you can't disprove it in a strictly logical sense. Science always works with certain initial assumptions. And all you need to do, which you cannot prove as such, you can't prove, for instance, that the laws of the universe are going to be regular throughout time. Maybe 10 minutes from now, they all shift. and there's a totally different game. You can't prove a lot of things like this in science. You have to assume them. Science is also built on the commitment to truth-telling. So all you need to do to accept that theory is add another assumption, namely that there's a God who likes to fool people, and this is what he's done. Now, you can't disprove that. All you can do is walk away from it as an awfully silly thing to believe. Does that make any sense?
But isn't one of the assumptions of science secular?
No, science was an invention of Christians mainly. Modern science, they built...